Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for coming to today's event. We are the President's Advisory Committee on the Status of Women, and today's event is our Women We Admire series. And before we get started, I wanted to tell you a little bit about PACSA. We examine issues regarding the status of women and try to improve the climate here at OP. We've sponsored activities such as the Take-In classes, Lean-In series, Making Power Moves class that we just finished in December, and this event, the Women We Admire series. For those of you who participated in Lean-In, in each of the sessions, we had poster paper up, and some of you have put external barriers. We had a huge list, and we've reduced it down from like 50 to 13 to a manageable list that PACSA can work on. So the two main issues we're working on this year are looking at a pay equity, a study here at OP, as well as looking at the flex time area. So those are just some of the things we're working on here at PACSA. Another thing PACSA has is the professional development sponsorship. So if you're planning to do any professional development activity or attend a conference, we do have an application process that may sponsor you. So look at our website for that information. Our next Women We Admire series event is Wednesday, March 11th. We're having a former UC Provost, Marcy Greenwood, who is also the former University of Hawaii President. So mark that in your calendar, Wednesday, March 11th. And my last thing is this spring we're going to be recruiting for new members. So look out in the link for that message. You can nominate someone or self-nominate, and there's an application process. And you can ask any of the PACSA members in the room if you have more information. So now, let's get started with our event. I'd like to introduce Margaret Wu, our chair of PACSA. My name is Jocelyn Benieri. I'm sorry to introduce myself. I'm now an analyst in the Academic Senate. I just started yesterday. I'm also co-vice chair of PACSA.
Yay.
Here's Margaret.
Thanks very much, Jocelyn. So it's my great pleasure and honor to introduce our guest speaker today, Cheryl Lloyd. Cheryl is the Chief Risk Officer here at the University of California. It's a position she's held since 2013, starting in an interim role. As the Chief Risk Officer, she has overall responsibility for the university's many risk services programs, including initiatives to reduce cost of risk, implementing safety programs, developing risk financing strategies, improving claim management systems, and oversight of the emergency management and business continuity planning for UC system-wide. Prior to her current role, Cheryl served as Director of Liability and Property Programs at the Office of Risk Services, and she's been here with us at UC since 1998. Cheryl is also a past... I know, can't tell. I'm starting when she was four. Cheryl is also past chair of PACSA, and many of you also know her as the ever-popular host of our annual employee talent show. Before coming to UC, Cheryl began her career in the insurance and risk industry with Chubb Insurance and was the corporate risk manager at Cormark International. She's also a UC alumna, having gotten her degree in mass communications at UC Berkeley. On a more personal note, I just wanted to share, Cheryl was actually on my interview committee when I first applied for a job here, so I can literally say I would not be here without her. But I have had the pleasure of working with Cheryl in my role here at OGC for a number of years, and she has always shared with me a great deal of her sense of humor and level-headedness whenever, you know, no matter what crazy email or panic call she's gotten. And she's really taught me a lot about the value of just sitting down and talking to people, even, you know, when you're dealing with the thorniest, most difficult questions, of just having those communication skills. So without further ado, Ms. Cheryl Lloyd.
All right, I'm going to tell you, I'm having a little moment here. I was on the charter committee for PACSA, and when we first started this series here at the Office of the President. and it was at a time where we felt that women who worked here needed to understand that there was a pathway for people to grow and to develop, and maybe to have people answer their questions about how do I succeed in my career, how do I balance my family life, my social life, et cetera, how do I go back to school, et cetera. And so we started this series, and it was great. The first series, Mary Krogan spoke. Mary, are you here? I think I saw you come in the room. So Mary spoke, and I went to the So I went to that very first one, and I thought, oh, man, am I an underachiever? Because, you know, Mary has a doctorate, and she's raising all these kids, and she's, like, trying to be a chancellor and all of that. And I was like, whoa, that's an amazing story. So each time you'd go to these talks, we'd come out, Karen Becky, who works with me, we'd come out and we'd go, oh, my God, can you believe what that person's done? So anyway, I am humbled to follow in the list of folks that have been invited to speak. And people would pass me in the hallways and say, when are you going to speak? And I'd say, shh, don't say it. And then I think it was Ellie finally said, okay, it's time, you know. And so here I am, and how cool is this? It's funny because I also told Karen, they were like, bring in extra chairs. I'm like, oh, I think we're doing just fine. It's lunchtime, and the sun is out, and there she is unloading chairs. It's all very weird for me. Now, I stole a page. I shouldn't say stealing, because if you use multiple resources, then it's research, right? So I've been to enough of these to kind of know how they should go. But I did take a page out of one that I attended. Dr. Barbara Allen Diaz from ANR kind of gave out, I think she's like gave out her top 10 things. So today I'm giving you kind of my top 6, and I'm calling them some of Cheryl's guiding principles. And it's a cute blue and gold handout that Karen did for me, and you'll get it on your way out the door. And I work with a lady here. She's here, Katie Pickard, and she says, you know, sometimes, Cheryl, you follow your guiding principles, and that's exactly what I do. And Barbara may have given you 10 things. I'm a mass comm major. I can talk quite a bit. I'm giving you 6, okay? And because I said to Karen, well, what am I going to talk about? She goes, you got to tell your stories, and it's true. My life is a story. Things happen, and they and if I don't have a story, I will meet somebody who will tell me a story, which then becomes one of my stories, right? Because people walk up to me and they tell me things that they would normally not tell other people, and it's just the way it works for me. But my life is enriched by it. I learn a lot of different things. So I've divided Cheryl's guiding principles into 2 categories, 2 columns, kind of a work-life balance and a career, because I know a lot of people, you're a working mom, working dad, and you're like, how do you balance it, right? And so I'm going to start by telling you, I'm going to start on the work-life balance side, because I really do believe family is first. That's how it's been for me. And children learn what's modeled. And so I have kind of a history of learning what is modeled. I come from parents and grandparents who all worked. And so just a snippet, my mother grew up in segregated Alabama. And my grandmother moved them out to California when my mother was a teenager. And she moved them out to California so that they could have a better life, right? And my mother was doing something in school, and the woman that my grandmother worked for would not allow her to come late so she could see my mom in whatever the program was at school. So my grandmother quit her job. But she needed to have a job, but she put her kids first. So that followed through when, of course, my mother raised us. So I come from a working-class family. My father worked at United Airlines for over 30 years. Remember before internet, you would walk up to the desk and you'd say, I'd like a ticket to go here, or I'd like a seat on the plane, aisle, window, et cetera. My dad was the guy that answered that question for you, and he did it for 30 years at United Airlines, which got funny later as I grew up and traveled for business. He would be at the airport from time to time. And if he wasn't at my specific gate, he would, someone would say, Ms. Lloyd, could you step to the podium, please? And they'd say, your father upgraded your seat. But his work hours were such that he had to be at work at 5 in the morning, and he got off at 2 in the afternoon. And his job primarily was to pick up me and my sister, make sure we started our homework, et cetera. My mother was an executive secretary for a labor union while I was growing up, around the corner from the school. And mind you, her modeling had been if her mother quit her job so she could see her kids be active in school, she never missed a moment that we did in school. And I don't care if it was a balloon blowing contest, she was there. And she was right behind us saying, you can be whatever you want to be. And she was so, you know, I went to a Catholic school in San Francisco. I'm a native San Franciscan. And, you know, first day of school, I was the only child of, I was the only African-American child in my first grade class. And so I met a friend, and her name was Cindy, and I came home, and I said, hey, Mom, got a friend named Cindy, and I was pretty excited about that. And the next day, I went to school, and Cindy told me she couldn't be my friend because I was black, right? She says, you're black. I can't be your friend. So I went home, and I told my mother, because I found this rather disturbing at 6. I knew this was disturbing, right? And I said, because I'm brown. What are you talking about? This is my first introduction to the fact that I might be a little different, right? And so, well, my mom was pretty gentle. She was very not so happy with the school, but pretty gentle, and told me that, you know, there are people in the world who will treat you differently because of the color of your skin, and this is your first lesson today. But that doesn't mean you're any different. You're just as good as those other folks, and you can do whatever you want to do. And but I think it became a little competitive for Mom, because when the report cards would come out, she'd want to know how many A's I got. Maybe how many A's did Cindy get? You know? And so later she became PTA president, and I went on to be the president of my eighth grade class. And, you know, but Mom was big into achievement, and you can do whatever you want to do. Now, when I say modeling, there was never a discussion about it, but somewhere around middle school, and I, you know, I was thinking about this last night, I don't even remember what year it was, she started going to night school. And so my father had graduated from college. My father went to an all-black college in Texas, and he had a business degree. And my mom she had gone to USF, but she had not finished college. But all of a sudden, she started going to night school. So she came over here and went to Merritt. She and her brother would carpool together and go to school. And she finished Merritt, and then she went to San Francisco State. And she was a labor activist, so she was running for office in her labor union, and I stood outside with her and passed out leaflets. I do recall that occurring. That was interesting modeling. But at any rate, she graduated from college when I was 16. We went as a family to watch my mom graduate, and even though there was no discussion about it, there was a message. That, you know, the message was, you will be going, because if she could work and go to school and provide for a family, then certainly there would be no excuse for us not going to college. So it was never discussed. It was absolutely understood. It was a matter of which one and how much it cost. Well, for me, I wanted to go to St. Mary's at first and then UCLA, and then she told me, the whole world is not small and Catholic when we talked about St. Mary's. And there are perfectly good schools within a BART ride from here. It's very practical, so you need to pick which one of those it is. So I picked San Francisco State because I should be a television anchor, and they had the best program. But then the acceptance letter came from Berkeley, and Dad said, wait a minute, you will go to Berkeley. I said, but what will I major in? He goes, you're smart. I'm sure you'll find something to major in. So I tried quite a few things. I tried economics, and I tried some other things. But when I went to a mass communications class, I thought, these are my people, the people who communicate. This is where I need to be, which I'm going to leap over to the next column, which is called under career. What's the appeals process? Now, my husband would title this, Cheryl doesn't take no very well. But I just say you need to have in your toolkit, what's the appeals process? So I'm searching all over Berkeley, looking for a major, right? And Berkeley is more theoretical when it comes to teaching in the area of radio and television and not hands-on. So my friends who are at Cal State Hayward and San Francisco State, they're in studios, et cetera. And so, but mass communications is a small department in the College of Letters and Sciences, and they only allow a certain, at that time, only a certain number of people to get in there. And so I applied, and then I go to see if I got in. When I, at that time, I think Letters and Sciences was in Evans Hall or whatever, and I look, and my name's not on the list. Well, I don't understand, because, you know, I have found my major, right? So I go to the counselor, whoever you need to talk to, and I say, my name's not on that list. And she says, oh, we only accepted 20. And so you didn't get in. And so I sit there for a minute, because there was no other choice, right? So I said to her, what's the appeals process? She said, excuse me? I said, well, surely if you take applications and you accept a certain number of people, there must be an appeals process. And she smiled and she said, we really don't have an appeals process, but let me look into it. So she looked into it, and magically, there was an appeals process. I appealed. I sit here before you with my mass communication. But I think that follows a theme in my life of it's not everything that you push, but it's finally when you find the thing that you really want to do that you decide now's the time. So under that same category, what's the appeals process? I applied for a job at Chubb Insurance. Now, I graduated, I have a dual degree, mass communications and sociology. What are you going to do with those degrees other than talk to people, go to law school, et cetera, right? So I'm fumbling around. I'm not sure what I'm going to do. And my mom cut out, my mother, a presence in my life. She cut out an ad in the paper. That's when we had ads in the paper. It was the Chronicle, and the ad said things like, do you like to communicate? Do you like meeting people? Do you like understanding what makes people tick? My mom said, here, there's a job for you. And the job was to be a claims examiner with Chubb Insurance Company and to go through an 18-month management training program, right? And so I'm all geared up. I am ready to do this, right? So I go through the interviews, et cetera, et cetera. And I finally meet the regional director, right? And so she's interviewing me. And so then she says to me, are you mobile? I said, excuse me, like I can walk, right? She says, no, after the training program, we often send you somewhere else to work, like Tulsa, New Jersey, et cetera. I said, oh, no. I am not mobile, right? I'm not going to Tulsa. Two other places I'm not going, right? And so she says, oh, that's so sad. And she folds her paper. She goes, because this job requires one to be mobile. And you say you're not. So I thought about it for a minute. And so I pulled out my folio, you know, the one you carry when you go on a job interview and has your resume on one side, right? And I opened it, and I pulled out my ad. And I gave it to her, and I said, can you show me here where it says that you need to be mobile? Because had I known that, maybe I would not have applied, right? And so she looked at me, and she said, I like your spunk. And so she said, I'd like you to go home and think about whether or not you'd be mobile. And then come back and let me know. So I went home, and I married very young, right? I married a year out of college. So I went home to my husband, and I said, this is a great job. They want to know if I'm mobile. And he's like moving out of California? Like not going to a 49er game? I mean, he goes, surely you're not mobile. He goes, I'll come visit you. As you can tell, he is not mobile. But anyway. But I made a decision. I thought about that. It's an 18-month training program. It's a roll of the dice where you'll end, either you could end up being placed here in the Bay Area. They had three offices in the Bay Area at that time. And if I needed to, if they wanted to move me to somewhere where I didn't want to go, then I'd have 18 months of this training and education under my belt. So I went back, and I was mobile. And I got into that program, and that's how I got into the insurance industry. So when my 18 months, well, as we were approaching the end of the 18 months, people would, you know, there were people in the office who knew. I was working in San Jose, California, and they knew I didn't particularly want to be mobile, and they'd walk by my cube and say things like, heard they have an opening in Tulsa, et cetera. And so, whatever. During your training time, if positions became open, they would always send the trainees to go look at those particular positions. So a position opened up in Concord, and I went and did that for a while. It was working property losses, and property's all good, but it doesn't really speak to me, so I really wasn't interested in that. And then in our San Jose office, a woman who handled workers' compensation every day, she left, and the manager really liked me, and he thought, you should probably do this job. And I'm thinking, nah, that doesn't – I'm gambling here, right? Because either I take a local job or think about being mobile. But that didn't speak to me either. So I liked liability, and that's kind of – when I came here, that's the job I worked in. Liability is when third parties sue someone. And I like the murkiness of it. Workers' comp is kind of cut and dry. You fell, you get a check, you know. Property's kind of cut and dry. The wind blew the fence down, you get a check. Auto's kind of cut and dry. Maybe you rear-ended them, maybe you didn't. Maybe you tried to flee the scene. Might be a little more interesting. And that's still in my well a little bit, too. But I kind of held out for the liability job. And you know what? I got it. You know, it turns out someone in our office was promoted, and so I started kind of doing what I wanted. But if I had turned away from my appeals process, then maybe I wouldn't have been, maybe I wouldn't be where I am today, quite frankly. All right. Let's go back to work-life balance. I'm hopping from column to column. For those of you that came in later, I had to give myself some guidance here. So I have these columns on work-life balance and career. With children, you don't get a do-over. That's just kind of how I think about it. And as I indicated earlier, as it was a model to me, I tried very hard not to miss things. I only have one child. He's 24. But when he was little, I tried not to miss things that he was involved in. Actually, when I came here, I didn't to work at UC. It reduced the amount of travel I had in my previous job because I felt I needed to be home more while he was growing up. This came to me when I came home from a business trip to Toronto, and I said to him, he was all excited he knew his phone number, so that's about two-ish, right? And I was like, oh, how did you learn that phone number? And he goes, Daddy told the Chinese food man. And I'm thinking, maybe I should be home a little bit. And so I just, you know, so I came here, and the travel here at UC was really, you know, I could drop him off. I could set my meetings. I could drop him off in the morning, catch a flight to L.A., do a meeting, be back home for the pickup. That's, you know, not everybody may work in that space, but that space is important for me to be visible to the child. I did miss, and I'll never, and it's like you still don't forgive yourself for doing that. I did miss, you know, one Halloween parade, I think it was. Now, the funny thing about this is I'm pretty outgoing, and my husband is the same. If you meet us, you get both of us. Our names rhyme. We're Cheryl and Terrell, and it's almost like a routine. We are very outgoing, but our child is not. And so, but that day that we missed that, I didn't know about that Halloween party. Somehow I missed it in the weekly envelope or whatever. But he would say, you weren't there. And, you know, it hurt me so much to hear him say that, you know. Now, the funny thing is, had we been there, he would not have done much. I'm pretty sure. I'm pretty sure I went to 8 holiday events, and he lip-sang through the whole thing, right? You know, he would raise his star or whatever. But I'm pretty sure he never really sang, you know. But I never missed one, you know. And so when it came to being involved in, you know, his sporting activities, he was in choir. I'm pretty sure he lip-sang through choir, too. But I was there. I'd get off work. I was at the, you know, I was at soccer practice when we first started getting involved in soccer. There I was in my blue dress and pearls with the other dads. They're like, who's the lady that's all dressed up? I didn't care. You know, except I did feel sometimes at the Little League part, some of those other ladies kind of looked at me like, why is she always in a suit? You know, and I thought, maybe I should just change before I go. Then I'm like, forget them. This is who I am, you know. So, you know, I would get there, you know, in time for it, and that was very important because you don't get the do-over. I don't get to go back and see what I missed. And if I couldn't go, I'm fortunate. I had an army of soldiers, so I could send my dad in or I could send my mom in. I mean, one time there was a roller skating party, and he wanted to go, and I was in L.A. I sent my mom. Key point, my mom can roller skate. So later that night, when I talked to Rob on the phone, I go, how was the party? He goes, Grandma can really roller skate. I said, I know, she's pretty awesome, you know. So I am fortunate. I did have a support system that helped me through that process. But I just think that's kind of one of my takeaways. And I'm going to stay in the work-life column and talk about spouse-partner support. I think that is huge. I mean, my husband was absolutely very much a partner in the child-raising category. Now, maybe because I was a claims adjuster, we kind of went into the marriage kind of like on a negotiation issue, you know, because I was like, now, what do you do? And he's like, well, I like to clean up. He's a neat guy. This really is in my favor, right? He goes, I like to clean up. Good. He goes, but I can't cook. I go, I've got that. So that was kind of our deal, like going in. You know, he would clean up and I would cook. I like to cook, and so that all worked out okay. And then, you know, we went on our honeymoon and we came back and we were doing the laundry, and then I get off the ironing board and he says, wait, let me iron my things first. I said, what did you say? He said, let me iron my things first. And I thought, I'm 23. I said, but this is a moment. I can let this go. Go right ahead. Iron your things, right? And because I had been raised in a household where I ironed uniform shirts, we went to Catholic school, I ironed all the uniform shirts. I ironed my dad's uniform shirts. I ironed those pleated skirts, so I really hate ironing, right? Let that go for a minute. And I thought, oh, that's great. But you know what I really found out? He's a neat freak, and so the reality is he thinks he can iron better than me. But you know what? He can. And I'm okay with that. So to this day, and we're on year 29, I might say, hey, can you press this blouse for me? He's like, yeah, and he's got it. And that's really good, you know? So, but when it came to raising the child, I was the PTA president, right? I just so happens I did a presentation. Somebody passed me in the hallway and said, you'll be PTA president next time. Works like that. But later when somebody would say, hey, what size shoe does Robert wear? I'm like, I don't know. He goes, what do you mean? I go, I don't do the shopping. My husband bought all the uniforms. He did all the shopping. He ironed those 5-corduroy pants every week, right? And then as the boy got older, when he was 10, he taught him how to iron those corduroy pants. The kid ironed, right? And so, and raising a boy, he was a 2-sport boy. You know what we introduced him to? The cool washing machine. And my husband bought the washing machine. My mother's like, why are you letting him buy the washing machine? I go, he does the laundry. Right? You should be happy with whatever you're working with, right? He got a red washer. 49er red, right? Blink, whatever, and we introduced the child to the washer at a very young age, and the child learned how to wash all his stuff. So so we worked that really well together, but it was helpful to have that partner and support in the background. Okay, let's go back to the career column. Because you have that support, you have to seize opportunities as they're presented to you, right? And so that's kind of what happened to me ending up in this job. Now, I'll tell you a little secret. So the year that my predecessor left was a big year for me. I was going to have a big birthday, and I was planning a big cruise, right? with 33 of my closest friends and family, because that's how I roll. I roll kind of with a posse, right? And she walked in my office and she said, hey, I've just given notice. I'm going to leave. And they're going to name you interim chief risk officer. I'm like, excuse me. This was not on my calendar this year. Because I had just turned over employment practices to Karen Petrolakis and Valerie and Kevin Confetti. So my life was not going to be bogged down by a bunch of conference calls there. I just saw freedom. Karen later sent me a note and said, bet you're not so free right now, right? But my life was changed. I was like, wait. So I walked into then Peter Taylor's office. I said, her leaving was not on my agenda. And he nodded. And I said, but my vacation is. And he said, then you must take it. And so I did go on that vacation, and it helped me clear my head and think about it. But anyway, that particular weekend stands out for me because a lot of people said to me, are you going to take this job? What are you going to do? I didn't know. It really wasn't on my agenda, and I didn't see it coming, right? So I find out on a Thursday she's leaving. On Friday, we tell the rest of the staff. On Sunday, I'm supposed to get on a plane and fly to Washington, D.C. to work on for a captive board meeting, right? On Saturday, my son, who's, you know, 22-ish, says, Mom, the movie 42 is out. We should go see the movie. And I say, about Jackie Robinson, right? And I said, I don't have time to go to a movie. I got to pack. I got to study. And he's like, Mom, you love baseball. We got to go to this movie, right? And we got to go as a family. Well, magic word. I don't care if he's 22 or 2, right? Put the suitcase down. I'm off to the movies, right? So we go to the movies as a family, and we're sitting there watching 42 and the Jackie Robinson story. And somewhere in there, the Dodgers owner turns to Jackie Robinson, and he says, Robinson, sometimes you have to have courage. You have to have the courage to lead, not just for yourself, but for the folks all around you who need you to lead them out. So I turned around to see if he was really saying that to Jackie or just me. Because I was like, is he really saying that? I mean, at this time in my crazy life, right? And I actually felt like he was saying that to me because I would pass some of you here in the hallway that's like, you're going to apply for that job, right? You're going to apply for that job. You're going to do that job. And I was just like, there were so many cheerleaders, but it had to be right for me. But I wasn't in that space yet. I had to get there, you know? So I get on the plane, and I read the first half of Lean In on the way out to Washington, D.C., and I read the second half of Lean In on the way back. And that's also a takeaway. I really got something out of Lean In. I know there's a lot of controversy. Some people didn't think they got things out of it. But I do think that sometimes women are reluctant to ask for what they want. And so where's Patsy? Patsy's my HR business partner. Patsy will attest that over the last year I have asked for some things that maybe in the past I would not have stepped up and asked for. And so I think you need to take that time to just ask, because if you don't ask, you won't know. And you might want to approach your boss with something, a new idea, an increase, a new position. But if they don't know you have that interest, it's not going to come to them automatically. You have to ask. So I got over myself. I seized the opportunity, and I became the interim applicant for a year. You know what that's like? That's like it's like The Voice. You watch that show, The Voice, right? Because you know you're an applicant, and every time you go to a meeting, it's like a battle round because you know these people are watching you to see how you perform. It's kind of interesting. But I have to put things like in perspective like that for myself. So I'm like, okay, battle round number 4. Let's go. Okay. Another thing I put on the column, I put 3 things in each column. Under the career column, I put understanding that leadership is leading. I have been a worker for so long, a doer for so long, in many different areas. You know, you call me, you're in the hospital, I'm like, I'm right there. You know, at when my son was in school, I was on every board or whatever you needed me to do, right? I'm a doer, and I've been called a fixer. That's another story I should tell you about. But when you get a position and you have quite a few people reporting to you, you have to step back and let them do it. And I think that's a hard adjustment for a lot of people when you're used to doing it. The key is understanding that they're not going to do it the way you might do it. As long as they get to the result that you need them to get to, that's okay. So back to my cruise. I'm pulling off. Now, some of you know in RISC, we handle the travel program. And our students often go off all over the world and get into places sometimes they shouldn't necessarily be, and they might need a little help getting out, right? So I had sent Peter an email Saturday from Florida before my cruise sailed. This is my last email, Peter. I'm just really testing that out, making sure he understood that, right? There won't be any emails for a week, right? And so he's like, have a great time. He was really good with that. Have a great time. So, but you know, as I was on the ship, and you know how they have that horn that goes off and the line dancing had started on the deck? That looked pretty fun, right? I took one last look at my phone, and it said, it was from iJet, which is the company we use to help us get students out of places, right? And it said, Cheryl, there is great unrest in Egypt, and we're going to need to come up with a plan for getting your students out of Egypt, right? And the broker wrote, the next email came in, she said, Cheryl Lloyd is on vacation. Gary Leonard is our contact for this issue. And I turned my phone off. Now, Gary says I threw it in the water. But I really did just turn off the phone, okay? And, sometimes in the staterooms you'd see, they'd have CNN. I could see, I'd see protests, and I'd wonder about it. And then I thought, maybe I should go up. If you pay a fee, you can log on. And I thought, that's the worst thing you could do is look over somebody's shoulder when they're doing their job. Let them do their job. They'll figure it out, right? And I think it pulled me even more because that's what I used to do. That was my wheel. That was my job before I was promoted, was to do, saving the children all over the world. And I was pretty proud of that, right? So, but now Gary gets to do my job, right? And I have to be okay with that. So I go down and have another cocktail of the day and let Gary rescue the children, right? And when I got back to Florida, and you go through this series, there's a ton of emails on this. But the last one was from Gary, and he said, thought you'd like the update. And it included a news clip of the students getting off the plane in the airport. And you know what? I deleted the 40 emails before that because I didn't need to know how it was done. All I needed to know was that it was done. And it got done Gary's way, not my way, and I'm okay with that. So, but that was probably the biggest growth piece for me most recently, was learning to let go, that there are really some smart people on our team that can get a lot done. Maybe, like I said, not the way I would get it done, but indeed, they get it done. And you know what? What's kind of cool about that is watching other people shine. So I have been fortunate enough to watch some folks on our team, some people who thought they were shy, et cetera, really blossom because they're allowed to do what they can do. And it's pretty awesome to see. So I only had one kid, so now it's kind of like having others is watching them, watching them grow. There is something about that. And so it's been a really neat opportunity. I'm going to do a little quick story about we did a team building event last week, right? And what I try to do is figure out that we could do something before the holidays. Well, that never works out because something about that losing those 2 weeks gets everything compressed. So apparently our annual team building event will always be the first Friday of February because that's when we can get it together. But anyway, I had people divide themselves up into teams, and the committee picked the theme this year was reality TV shows or shows based in TV reality. And so I don't know if you, how many folks you know in risk services. We're fairly competitive folks. And so so they got in, they got in their little groups, and they decided what the what they were going to do. So Kina, who works for me, sent me a text on a random Saturday. You are Olivia Pope. You're the fixer. And so I hadn't really watched Scandal, and so she said, you know, she sent me, get on Netflix, check this out, you know. And so we put together a little thing, and I even went out and bought a wig. It was, but I'm totally in, and now I have to watch apparently 4 seasons of Scandal, and I don't know how that's going to happen. But, so I do fix things. I do a bit of that. So it resonated with me, you know. But I love the fact that people can work in their teams and how creative they are. So there was another team. It was Shark Tank, kind of, right? And so you, in risk services, some of you in this very room come and pitch ideas to us for which you'd like us to fund, right? So one team thought they would be like, you know, the Shark Tank, right? And so it was I was a little put off. Well, liked it a little bit. It was kind of cool. The woman who pitched came out with a helmet. Now, you know those helmets that you wear or you see crazy people wear with the beer cans on the side? And so she pitched, what did she call it? It was like a chief caffeinator or something like that. And it was 2 coffee cups. So the coffee cups would go here because they said keeping a caffeinated chief is important for survival and resilience. And it's kind of true. But my takeaway from that is when you lead and when people work hard for you every day, because I do believe these people work hard every day, then you got to let them blow off a little steam. You could tie it back to the work. Everybody had to tie back what their group was doing and why it's related to their team. You know, that's kind of the risk financing team that kind of put together that pitching piece because that's what they do. You know, they hear these pitches for more money all the time. So, you know, I'm kind of different that way in that I really want people to grow, to do their own jobs, but to really enjoy the workplace because they give that back to you. So, in closing, and I think you can start passing those out or put them in the back or whatever. And we probably I'm thinking may not have enough, but I'll send a link and somehow they'll get to other folks. Number 7, which I put down on the bottom. So I take you through these. Work-life balance under column 1 is children learn what's modeled. So what you show a child, that's what they do. By the way, when I go places where my son works, they always say to me, wow, he really works hard, you know, but that's what he has seen, right? So number 1, children learn what's modeled. Number 2, under work-life balance, with children you don't get a do-over. Number 3, spouse, partner support is very helpful if you have it. If not, build the village, right? Career, what's my line? What's the appeals process, right? Under career again, seize opportunities as presented. Be open, you know, be open to letting things happen to you. Take a leap. Be mobile, even though you may not be. Just saying, okay? Understand leadership, that it's really leading. It's not necessarily always doing. And at the bottom, I gave you a clip for one of my favorite things, Jill Scott. So I commute 30 miles to work, and music gets me there. And I'm not going to sing for you, though. I hear the song in my head. I'm going to tell you. Live life like it's golden. You only get one. And if you think about how you treat gold, you know, you treat it with a little respect, right? You keep it clean. You keep it shiny. You don't lose it, et cetera. Think about your life like that. And maybe it's more important to me because I've had the big birthday, right? But now, you know, you kind of know folks who are going through breast cancer or who have had other tragedies in their life, right? Take the time to live life like it's golden. And this is such an upbeat song. So what is it you like to do? If you like to dance, dance. If you like to sing, sing. Every other year, I take a trip with, I belong to an African-American sorority, and every other year, where we're scattered all across the country, the girls that I went to Cal with, we meet in a city for 3 days, and though we're not, somehow over those 3 days we're kind of 21 again. And maybe I need a Tuesday to recover. But we kind of pick up exactly where we left off, and it can be anywhere from 10 to 15 of us. We've done New York. We go see plays. We've done New Orleans. We won't talk about that. We've done Vegas. But life is about more than work. Work is very important, but a happy person performs much better. That's just kind of my mantra. So live life like it's golden. And I left 10 minutes, questions, et cetera. Any questions? All right, you go click on that video then, and you'll be singing. See, this is why you don't have your staff. You know, so she said that I didn't talk about my junior miss experience. So many years ago, I was San Francisco's junior miss. And it is kind of a funny story because they kept sending me, California's junior miss kept sending me things and asking me to participate. And I didn't want to participate necessarily because I thought it was like a pageant. And then my mother, the force, called the school and told me, you need to catch the bus home, put on that blue dress, and we're going to this meeting about this junior miss thing. And I said, why? She goes, Cheryl Ann. It's an opportunity for a scholarship, right? And I was like, and she says, you don't have to wear a bathing suit. You have to have good grades. You have to have poise and appearance. You're going to wear one of those prom gowns. And so, you know, and you have to be interviewed by a panel of people, et cetera. So off to the meeting I went. And I'm sitting there with some other girls and their parents, right? And then they talk about the process. If you win, so you have to learn an athletic routine. Don't laugh. I was a good dancer one time. You have to learn an athletic routine. Once again, you have to go through the interview. So they're walking you through all the things you have to do. And then if you win, you go to Santa Rosa, where they have – I didn't mean it like that. I was just trying to remember. Was it Petaluma or Santa Rosa? But you go to Santa Rosa for California's junior miss, right? And so my mom asked, she asked the people, the Kiwanis were hosting it, what happens if you win? You go to Santa Rosa. She asked the question, what's the housing arrangement like? This is what I should key you in. My mother was the original risk manager. She was way ahead of the game, right? And so they said, there's host homes. My mother, who vets these people? So this other lady was getting kind of annoyed, and she said, that's only if you win. She said that to my mother. My mom's 5'2", but she just looked at her, silenced her with the look, right? She needed to have these questions answered, right? So then we find out, you have the host home, you stay up there a week, you do 3 nights of performances, et cetera. So now I go to practices for the local program, San Francisco's Junior Miss, but it's turns out it's on the same night as my winter ball. Now, I'm 16. My parents were really strict. I finally am allowed to date. I finally have a boyfriend, right? I could care less about this Junior Miss thing, right? I got a boyfriend. I want to go to this winter ball, right? And so my mom's like, you tell him to come to the program and – when you win, you can then go to your winter ball, because she's pretty clear on how this is all going to go down. So I go through the whole thing, and here's something else I learned. This is my first panel interview. Of course, coming to UC, I've had many panel interviews since then, right? But it's my first panel interview. And here's something I learned at 17. It's okay to say, I don't know, right? So they asked me some questions, and I quite fascinated by that question. I'm like, you know, I really don't know. I'm going to have to look into that. But anyway, I guess I showed confidence because I was okay with saying, I don't know. This is what I found out later. But anyway, night of the show, I'm on the stage. For my talent. I did a jazz dance. I did take jazz dancing for many, many years. So I did dance. And they start announcing first runner-up, second runner-up, and it's becoming really clear. I may have won this thing, right? So they do the first runner-up, and then they're like, San Francisco's junior miss is Cheryl Alton, was my maiden name, right? The funniest thing is my grandma, you know how your grandparents, they lose the ability to whisper somewhere somewhere around 70, right? My grandma's sitting there, and she's like, thank you, Jesus. And so I start laughing and crying because I'm like, holy crap, I have won this thing. My, you know, and my mom looks back at that lady who said to her, my mom's looking at her in the back of the room, right? But I'm seeing all this stuff go down. I'm thinking this is very, so anyway, so I go on to be San Francisco's junior miss, and now I have to go to Santa Rosa. Now, my family's both immigrated from southern parts of the United States, Texas for my dad, Alabama for my mother. As a young African-American girl, you do not go stay in people's host homes that they don't know anything about, right? It's just that's how it works. So two carloads of folks took me up to Santa Rosa. Interviewed my mom and my dad and my little sister and then my great aunt Vera and Mrs. Crawford, who was the lady across the street. But two carloads of people went up, and it was a young dentist. It was a young Caucasian family. It was a dentist and his wife and two girls, right? And you know, I was thinking they had a great house. It was a great experience, but I think they were interviewed a bit, and I had a fantastic experience, and they were very nice to me. But looking back over the years, it was a really kind of odd situation. So, yeah, so the team teases me quite a bit about the junior miss deal, but there's things to be learned in every experience. That's all I got to say. All right. Yes, Eric.
Tell me about how you went from jail to the university. Sort of a story.
Oh, I went from Chubb to the university. So at Chubb is a commercial insurer. So a lot of you at home, you might have State Farm, AAA, Farmers, and they handle really kind of your personal insurance matters. Chubb, AIG, CNA, those are large commercial insurers. So I was working in the Silicon Valley, and I had large accounts. I worked for Apple. I worked for Silicon Valley groups. So a lot of mine were large companies that had what you call large deductibles. So I'm on the phone with some of these risk managers, and I'm thinking they would call and ask me questions. Well, if so-and-so got in an automobile accident in Alabama, then how do we handle it there? And I go, well, it depends on what the DMV. So I'm answering their questions, and I think, hey, I bet they get paid more than I do. And I'm answering these questions, right? So I applied for a job at Apple, and the risk manager there, I made it to, like, number two. They wanted someone with more of a workers' comp background, but she told me, you'd probably be good in risk management. You should join the local RIMS, which is an organization for risk managers, and you should take a look at looking at that career. So I left Chubb, and then, because I was still trying to find myself, okay, what do I want to do now? I left Chubb, and I went to another insurance company, which is a personal lines carrier. And I realized that that was not a good fit, because there I was handling, like, you know, people who were in automobile accidents, and they had their, like, 1974 Volkswagen Bug, and you tell them, well, it's only worth $200, and they would cry and get upset. And I'm like, that's not how I want to live my life. So I have to find another gig, right? So I took a job at Cormark International. They were looking for a risk manager that had a claims background because they had high deductibles, similar to what we do as a university. So they wanted to know, how can you manage the risk within your own money? So I went to Cormark International. And they had a headquarters in Oyster Point down in South San Francisco. And they had locations all over Western U.S. and Canada. And so I was their risk manager. Now, it truly was a pretty much white, male-dominated company. It was warehouse and trucking. And so I took a look at their, you know, workers' comp, and I said, hey, you know, you need to start returning people back to work because your costs are going up. And they would say, little lady, we're not sending a half man back into our warehouse, right? And that was kind of that environment. And then once a quarter, they would have meetings called Chicken with the Chief. The owners of the company were from Amarillo, Texas, and they really liked fried chicken. So once a quarter, they'd bring in fried chicken and put it up on the counters, and they'd order salads for the rest of us Californians. And then they would, we'd come in and we'd have lunch, and they would give us like the state of the union of the company, how it was performing. And one day they asked a young lady to stand up because they would introduce new employees, and they asked a woman to stand up, and she was shy. And the owner of the company looked at her and he said, little lady, if I was as pretty as you, I'd be paying people. I'd be asking people to pay me to stand up or something like that. So, as a risk manager, I thought this was a problem. So, I went to HR and I said, hey, you can't have him doing that. He goes, Cheryl, we just got him to stop patting people on their head last week. Give us some leeway. We are working with him. So I knew my term there wasn't going to be long. But I was there 3 years. I got what I needed to get, which is really working in claims and be a risk manager there. It was my first relationship, quite frankly, with some of the large brokers, and that's really where I learned the skill. And then I came here. I applied for a job. This is, I'm Googling stuff. I applied for a job to be a risk manager, which I thought was at Berkeley. I didn't know the office of the president existed. And I came here, and I met with John Lundberg and Ann Broom and some others, and took this particular job, but that's how I made the leap here. Okay. Anything else? It's 1 o'clock. The whistle has blown. Gotta go back to work.